Welcome to the Paddy Palin Adventurous Series of Podcasts. Explore your world, live your passions, expand your horizons, live in the now, travel to the ends of the earth, love our environment and dream big dreams. Paddy Palin, the leaders in travel and outdoor adventure, are proud to present the Adventurous Series of Podcasts to help fuel your passion for the outdoors and faraway places. Check the Paddy Palin website or sign up to our RSS feed to listen in to our other adventurer podcasts. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I thought there would come a day when I woke up and thought, that's what I'm going to be when I grow up. For me, that defining day never really arrived, but I'm still kind of waiting for it. In the meantime, I've had half a dozen different careers and done a million different things, and I've come to the conclusion that diversity is what I'm meant to do if I ever actually grow up. So I've always been rather awestruck and envious of those people that just knew what they wanted to do or be from an early age and just went for it, no holds barred. I'm Kerry Lorimer, and today I'm talking to Kevin Westren, who decided very early in life that he wanted to be a climber. Today, approaching 70, after half a century of following his passion, he's still at it. No holds barred. Well, not many anyway. Kevin's pretty legendary in climbing circles in the Blue Mountains, which are essentially the backyard for Sydney climbers. As a cragster, he's been around longer than just about anyone, and pioneered numerous routes throughout the late 50s, 60s, and right through to the 1980s, he was still exploring new territory. Just have a look at any guidebook to the Blue Mountains and you get a sense of what a wonderful contribution Kevin has made to the sport of climbing. Kevin joined Paddy Palin back in 1977, first working on the shop floor in sales and moving through a range of roles to today, where he's the company's online content manager. Throughout those years, he's never lost focus on what drives and inspires him. Hi Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Hi Kerry, nice to talk to you.
Yeah. Now, climbing has been a pretty single-minded passion for you from a pretty young age. What drew you to it in the first place and what captured you so strongly that you've dedicated such a large part of your life to it?
Well, I guess I found at school that I wasn't really a ball sports person I didn't enjoy sort of large teams. Small teams, fine, but not large teams. I wasn't good at those sorts of activities like football and cricket. And I guess once I'd started climbing, I found that it was something that I could be good at and that I enjoyed.
Okay. And so how did you first come to climb? Tell us a bit about your first climb.
Well, of course, children climb from an early age unless they're stopped by their parents. It's just a natural thing to do. Even at sort of 18 months old, I suppose, you see them trying to climb onto things. And I was no different. I climbed trees and rocks. But I hadn't really thought that anybody else did it, certainly not adults. And I decided to start doing some walking and eventually found or thought I needed a Paddy Palin rucksack to be a proper bushwalker.
Yes, you do.
Yes, you do. And in those days, anyway. And I went into Paddy's store to buy a rucksack. And on the signboard there, they had advertisements for various clubs, and one was Sydney Rock Climbing Club. And suddenly I realised that what I'd been doing sort of informally was a formalised activity undertaken by people that were, well, basically adults.
Right, more or less.
More or less, yes. So, although not considered by some people in the public, I suppose, to be adults. But that was on a Thursday. I telephoned the number that night and spoke to Dave Roots from Sydney Rock Climbing Club. He told me what they were doing on the weekend, and that weekend, on the Saturday night, I went to the mountains to climb on the Sunday.
Right, okay. But from what I remember, you said that you actually sort of spent, you had a pretty basic night that first night, right?
That's correct. I had a rucksack, but I didn't have a sleeping bag, so I couldn't camp in the mountains with the other climbers. So I caught a very late train to Katoomba and sat in the waiting room where there was a coal fire in those days till it was close to morning. and then walked down to the Three Sisters to find the people I was wanting to meet and climb with.
So pretty dedicated right from the start. But how did you go on that first day?
Well, there were a lot of things that didn't work out as planned. I mean, there was nothing dangerous or there were no accidents, but just that the people I'd been hoping to find already there had gone lower down the mountains on Saturday night for a party, so they were nowhere to be seen. I waited around at the Three Sisters for quite some time. It was already light and getting a bit warmer, and I got bored with this and wandered down the giant staircase to the halfway ledge, which is a fairly large sloping ledge with vegetation on it that runs right around the Three Sisters.
You can pretty much see it from the lookout, can't you?
You can see it from that lookout, yes.
Okay.
But I was on the other side, the side away from the lookout, where the staircase goes down, and I wandered out along that ledge, sort of didn't know quite what I was looking for or what I might find. And I heard a sound off in the distance that I'd never heard before but had read about in books, and knew that it was an iron piton being hammered into a crack. And when I looked up, I could see a rope hanging down against the skyline but no people, and I thought, well, that must be the Sydney climbers. I wandered back towards the staircase and found a gully going upwards that took me up and into a chimney, and I clambered up in the chimney and out under the roof.
So you're doing all of this with no protection or anything at this point?
No protection. but then climbing was a bit like that anyway in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I found myself eventually on top of the Second Sister, which is the middle one, the pointy one.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there in the sun and waited for the climbers, hopefully, to appear. And eventually they did, two chaps. And they weren't Sydney rock climbers at all. They were off a P&O liner that was in Sydney for a couple of days.
And I'm guessing they're a little bit surprised to see you sitting there without any gear.
They were surprised to see me, and they asked me quite nicely, would I be able to get myself back off again? And I said, oh, I think so.
Yeah.
But at that point, a group of people turned up at the nearest lookout and shouted out to us, get off our rock. And this was
these were the
Sydney
bunch.
Rock climbers.
Yeah, welcoming. Well, welcoming.
Yes, very, very welcoming, yes. Climbing in those days was very parochial. There wasn't much interaction between the different centres like Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and so forth. And I guess they felt that they knew every climber in Sydney.
Right. And you were just a young upstart.
Oh, well, I did come to know all the climbers in Sydney later. There weren't that many of them in those days. But anyway, the two visiting climbers were going to help me get off, but the Sydney Rock Climbing Club came round the easy way from the lookout and guided us, all of us, off back to Honeymoon Point, where we had a big discussion.
Right, so your first climbing experience was basically a solo first ascent?
Yes, that's correct,
right.
Yes.
Okay. So that was back in 1957. It obviously gave you the passion for it.
Yes.
You went on to complete many first ascents in the Blueies, pioneered new routes and new areas. There was a lot of virgin territory that you covered. Do you think there was more danger in the sport back then? I mean, you were sort of saying that it was really quite a different scene.
Well, the equipment was very, very basic.
Mm-hmm.
We tied manila rope around our waist with a bowline.
Mm-hmm.
We had maybe one or two circular slings of a similar rope, slightly smaller diameter, with a carabiner, a steel carabiner on each one of those slings.
Right.
Carabiners weren't in ready supply, and there wasn't much climbing equipment, if any, really sold in Australia at that stage. Now, with just that very, very basic equipment, it meant that you, between what climbers call pitches, which is where one person stays while the other climbs, there were very few intermediate points of contact that would stop you from falling a long way.
Right.
So, yes, it was dangerous, but it was coped with by people climbing well, well, well below their limits.
Right, okay.
Nobody climbed to the point where they found what their limit was, because that was only found if you fell off, basically.
Yeah.
And people, climbers aren't aren't daredevils. They aren't people with nerves of steel.
Really?
They
I
are
always
generally.
thought they were. Looking at them, I always thought they were.
That's maybe how it looks, but it's not the reality of the situation. It's a very judgmental thing. You make a decision for yourself whether you feel comfortable and think that you
Right.
can do the move, and you make the decision to do it or not do it on that sort of basis. Sometimes you have to do it, and that sort of is what we call commitment, when you actually do a thing that you're a little bit concerned about. But now, of course, yes, there is more equipment, better equipment, and better techniques. And so the level of potential danger has been brought right in down and under control to a very high degree.
And
There's still an element of danger,
has that sort of influenced the attitude and the approach of climbers, do you think? I mean, you said that you were climbing well within your limits. Do you think that that has changed as a result of the technical innovations?
it's definitely changed. People now are in on certain types of climbs, depending on how close together the intermediate points of protection are, they risk falling, say, 2, 3, 4 feet, or let's say 1.5 to 2 meters.
As opposed to 50.
Yes, well, twice the rope length potentially.
Oh, just as an in,
So.
as a as a as a guide, where if you had fallen off the three sister, the second sister, when on that day, how far could you have fallen?
Oh, well, fall and then roll. Well, depends. You'd be dead by that stage. But at 300 feet, perhaps. Now, I'm still talking feet. I should probably be meters, I
No, we
suppose.
get
But yep,
it. Whatever way you look at it, it's a long way.
it's a long way. Yes.
So you were saying, sorry when I interrupted, that these days you'd sort of maybe fall 2 or 3 meters or 2 or 3 feet.
Well, 2 or 3 meters. Some people have fallen quite a lot further than that without damaging themselves. And this is partly because the equipment is better, and partly because these days people climbing in the highest standards are invariably climbing on vertical surfaces or surfaces that are overhanging. And that means when you fall off, you are less likely to hit something. And falling into air with the rope then arresting you is relatively safe and relatively comfortable if you've got the right equipment.
Okay, so it's really kind of it's changed. And how have climbers themselves changed physically or in their mental approach to it?
Well, nowadays, those who want to be up in the higher levels of climbing proficiency and ability undergo physical training. They will be lifting weights and doing all sorts of physical exercises to increase their power to weight ratio. Many of them undertake sort of philosophical approaches to getting their mind sorted, to accept the situations that they find themselves in and cope quite calmly with the potential dangers and so forth. And there's a the techniques that they're practicing, the ways of using the ropes and so forth, they're all much, much better these days.
So it's kind of progressed in line with all sorts of other elite sports. But when you started out, you had some wonderful mentors, some fairly hallowed names. Tell us a little bit about them and what you distilled from their knowledge.
Well, I think I've been recorded in print as saying that I had three mentors. The first of them was Douglas Litchfield, an English climber who had come out to live in Australia. He's not famous, he's not well known. In fact, he himself would say that he is not worthy. But he had an incredible sense of humour and an equal sense of the ridiculous. And he taught me as a young lad, because he was 10 years older than me, and so that meant he was the sage, wise old man. He taught me not to take myself seriously, to be able to see humour in things and not be pompous, I guess, as some young men of 18, 19, and so forth can be. And that was a marvellous lesson for me. And I still get out with Dougie from time to time. He's over 80 now, but he still gets out. And we have gatherings every now and then and tell all the old stories and recount all the old lies of the past.
Which always get
And
better.
that's they always
Like
get
a
better.
fine wine.
We get better in the
Absolutely.
stories too. Yes. Anyway, he was my first, I suppose. My second mentor was Harry Luxford. He's a Blue Mountains climber and quite an icon, quite well known in the Blue Mountains. And he taught me that I could climb harder than I had thought I could in the past. And he also taught me about committing myself to make the hard moves. When you get to the point and you think, oh, I don't like this or I can't do this. If you've got the right pieces of protection and so forth placed relatively closely, he taught me to make the move and accept the fact that you might fall off.
How did he do that? When you say that, was it sort of he gave you the mental mettle to do it, or
he talked at me, I suppose. Yeah. You know, when he saw me pausing, he would say things like commitment, Kevin, commitment. And I eventually I steeled myself and I made the move, and there was no problem. It was just largely a head thing.
Yeah, so it's kind of a school of tough love.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and then after Harry, I met an English climber who was in Australia, an elderly gent who everybody loved him. He had friends, climbing friends, in almost every part of the world. And he was very highly respected. And I guess what I learned from him, Dennis Kemp, this is, that you keep on doing it for as long as you want to.
Okay.
He was then in his 70s.
Wow.
And so it was a lesson to me that you get to be 40, you get to be 50. Mm. If you still want to do it, you may have to lower your standards of the climbing that you're doing, but you can keep on doing it.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm still doing it.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing, I have to say. Do you have a favourite climbing memory?
Oh, yes. There are many, many memories of quite important times in my life, in my climbing life, I suppose. And there in Australia and overseas. But the one abiding one, the one most important one, goes back to the very early days, the early 1960s, when I was climbing in the Warrumbungle National Park in western New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And my brother and I went to a crag there, a big volcanic crag called Crater Bluff. And from the lookout on the walking track, there was a corner rib of rock. So you had two faces, the north face and the west face, joining at this particular corner. Mm-hmm. And a rib of rock, which about one third of the way up from the base, became fairly narrow. From a broad buttress base, it became a very narrow rib of rock, about, say, 2 meters wide. Mm-hmm. It hadn't been climbed, and so we decided we'd go and have a look at it.
As you do.
As you do, yes. And we climbed it. We came to the hard point on the climb, and it looked too hard for us, and so we found a way around it and then back onto the rib and then climbed all the way to the top. Mm. And I remember being within sight of the top and being sure that we were going to get to the top. And I was sitting on a ledge, bringing my brother up, taking in the rope as he climbed, and I found myself singing. It was just such a joyous situation.
Yeah.
And there have been other incredible situations, other incredible climbs that I've enjoyed and have been landmarks in my climbing, I suppose. But that one, I guess, has to be number one.
And was it achieving that top, or was it was sort of more the personal challenge? And hey, what were you actually singing?
It was a long time ago, Kerry. I don't remember what it was.
I'm just wondering what might come to mind in that situation.
I can't remember. It would have been out of tune. But no, it wasn't so much the getting to the top. That was important because that was then gave us a way down,
yeah.
A relatively easy way down, mm-hmm. and a way down that I knew. No, it was just the passage, the journey of actually finding that we could make a way to the top,
mm-hmm.
rather than being at the top. I mean, being at the top was great. That was the culmination, and there's a spectacular view over a large part of that national park from there,
and
the surrounding peaks. It's a very spectacular spot. And it's just the process of doing the climb and achieving that thing. And this was the first ascent too. They said it made it a little bit more memorable, I suppose.
Of course. How much does the mind over matter principle come into a climb like that? And how and when does the mind factor come into play?
I suppose to a degree it does. It does play a part, and how much it plays a part, I guess, is how serious or how dangerous or how hard the climbing is. On that particular climb, Cornerstone Rib in the Warren Bungles, the climbing wasn't difficult.
Right.
In fact, the difficulty, we went around it. I've since gone back and with my brother done that difficult part anyway, and so we've done the whole thing continuous. But it didn't require a great deal of mind strength. It was exploratory, really, trying to find a passage that we could actually cope with to get us up to the top.
Mm-hmm. So it's really the challenge of actually getting there.
To me, yes. I mean, different people have different views about climbing and different objectives and seek different pleasures, I suppose. For some, it's just the physical pleasure of actually making the moves, of moving from one handhold to another and doing it smoothly and gracefully. To some, it's achieving the hardest climb ever, or their hardest climb ever, doing the hardest climb in the world, or whatever it may be. People vary in their reasons for climbing, I guess. And that's what makes climbers so individually different from one another.
Such a diverse crowd.
Now, yes.
Some of the routes and rocks you've climbed are now off limits to climbers, and the National Park Service and other bodies have restricted access on environmental and safety grounds. You've seen the changes over the years. You're now the Access and Environment Officer for the Sydney Rock Climbing Club, and you've worked with national parks and with local government. What's the future that you'd like to see for these sorts of partnerships between management authorities and climbers and other recreational users?
Well, first and foremost, I guess, is a better understanding by both sides of the legitimate position of the other side. Mm-hmm. In other words, for national park authorities or managers of protected areas to understand that rock climbing is a legitimate activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's undertaken in many, many countries in the world. And in those countries that have a long history of mountains and mountaineering, climbing is a very, very legitimate activity.
Mm-hmm.
Australia, of course, is not that well supplied with real mountains, and so
they're a little bit flat, really, aren't they?
Climbers, yes, that's right. Climbers are seen perhaps as a fringe element, and not necessarily understood all that well. And certainly for some people, they don't have a legitimate place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would like to see us work towards, and in my position as access officer and the Barbara Darmanin, who held the role before me, we've been working to get that sort of legitimacy and dialogue going with the land managers, and it's progressing,
mm-hmm.
but there's further to go.
Right, okay. And so you're still climbing actively. What's on the cards? Where are you off to next?
Well, I don't climb as frequently as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it just as much, perhaps a little more because it's less frequent, I suppose. So it's in that sense more important and more valuable. Later this year, I'm retiring, and very soon after I retire.
Retiring from work, not from climbing.
Retiring from work, yes. Very soon after I retire, there is a group of people from Sydney going to Mount Arapiles in Victoria, which is a very well-known mm-hmm. destination.
Very respected for the climbs there.
Oh, it's internationally known and respected, yes. And this group of older people,
right.
Go there at least once a year, usually in autumn or in the late spring, sometimes both.
Is this a regular group that you belong to?
Oh, it's a changing group, but yes, sometimes some people will be there one time and not there the next time, and then there the third time,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But this year we're going in October rather than November, so that some of them who have children can take their children along with them
excellent.
In the school holidays.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah, will be.
Yeah. And will you be
another generation of climbers.
Yeah. And I know that your 70th birthday is coming up around about September, is that right? So will you be celebrating with the climb?
Probably. I'll be celebrating with some of my old buddies.
Mm-hmm.
We're having a weekend in the Blue Mountains, the last weekend in August.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll drink lots of medication.
Yes.
And that will make the story even better. And hopefully we'll get out and do a climb.
Well, I would love to be a fly on the wall for that little celebration. That's fantastic.
Well, yeah, because some of the people, there are at least two of the people who'll be there, are over 80.
Wow.
And so they are the inspiration for me as well.
Mm. Well, I'm sure you're an inspiration for the next generation as well.
Well, I don't know about that.
Oh, I reckon you are. Kevin, thanks so much for your time today. That's been a fascinating story. And, yeah, happy birthday.
Thank you very much, Kerry.
That was Kevin Westren, veteran of half a century of Blue Mountains climbing. Kevin's wonderful story goes to show that even if you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, life's about the journey, not the summit. You can keep doing whatever you want to do as long as you want to do it, as long as you don't take yourself too seriously, and as long as you're prepared to make a commitment, Kevin.